We are ready to begin our third class. Our speaker is Brother Jason Hensley. The theme for Brother Hensley's classes this week is the beginning of Christ's story. Today's class is entitled The Shepherds.
Morning, everybody. Oh, you sound very chipper today. I like it. That's good. You're ready. All right. So if you follow that QR code, you may notice it's slightly different. And that's because there are now two folders, one from this series and one from last night. So just so you don't get confused, it is still the same link and you still have access to everything, but it's divided up that way. Okay, so we're talking about the shepherds today, and that means that we get to talk about Christmas. So don't worry, you know, it's not gonna get weird, but it is important. I mean, like, you know, this is where the whole story comes from and everything. So we're gonna take a look at this. What we're gonna notice is there's some things that we say about that time period that maybe are right, maybe aren't. There's a lot of things that other people say about this time period that are clearly wrong. So we're going to work through all of this just so that we can have educated discussions with people about it, that we can have some good sources. And ultimately, what we're going to see as we go through this is that the Lord Jesus is for everyone. Not just for the poor, not just for the rich, but for everybody. And I think that's very much underscored in this message. And for me, I think that's really one of the most powerful things, right? That grace is going to change things. We've seen that. We have seen that we want to ponder God's ways. And yet to recognize then that grace and that working of God is available not just to some people, but it's offered to everyone, regardless of where we're at, how we're doing, that we can approach and find God if we are seeking him. I think that that is very, very powerful and very strong thing to remember. Now, because of that, you will notice it is twice as long as our other core messages. So I'm figuring you're ready to up your game today. So we've gone up to 6 words. Okay, we have 3 sections. We're going to talk about the details. So that is the details of the shepherd story, which is looking at the details of how the story actually does not fit at all with the Christmas narrative. Then we will talk about shepherds and who they were in Jewish society. That means we're going to spend some time on historical sources. So I will open that up for you, the history pieces, and kind of explain what sources we're looking at. And then we're going to talk specifically about the proclamation of the angel to the shepherds and what we can see from that. So those are our 3 sections. The why question is, why were shepherds invited to Christ's birth? Again, we're so familiar with the story. We're kind of like, oh yeah, shepherds. But if you stop and think about it, that's somewhat random, right? That would be like if somebody said, oh, and all the cooks were there. You'd be like, what? You know, but why are there chefs at a baby's birth? You know, like last time I thought about it, none of us were like, oh, I'm going to have a baby. Go to a local farm and bring some shepherds. Like that's not normally a thing that we do when like babies are born. So why is it that it's specifically shepherds who show up at the birth? Okay. So let's try and understand that a little bit. Now, before we go into this, I would like you to just take a moment and please appreciate my cute sheep picture. Right? Like this took me a while to find. So I think that, you know, that's very nice. Okay. Now, that actually is relevant, by the way, because I'd like to point out, notice the sheep are in snow, right? Just keep that in the back of your mind, okay? All right. Now, you can enjoy this picture too. I thought about opening this up and asking you, but you can just think about it on your own, on what's wrong with this picture. Yeah, there's a lot of things here that are issues with this, including the giant pine cone, right? There's an issue with that too. I'm not sure what's happening there, but But there's a lot of issues with this picture. And as we go through this, we're going to see that there are some big problems with what actually matches the scriptural record. Again, this is one of the things I actually find this really fun. When I'm talking to some of my university students, I'll say like, everything you thought about the Christmas story is wrong. Right. And we get to work through this. One of my favorite things to say, and this is just a useful point of trivia too, if you ever end up on Jeopardy or anything like that. So if you win, remember me. So just think about that. This is something important to know. In John chapter 10, Jesus celebrates Hanukkah. I don't know if you've ever seen that, but in John chapter 10, it's not called Hanukkah because that's the Hebrew name, but it's called the Feast of Dedication, right? So Jesus celebrates Hanukkah, and do you know what he doesn't ever celebrate? Christmas, right? So he never celebrates Christmas, but he celebrates Hanukkah. And I love saying that to the students because they just like stare at me for a long time and they're like, what? How could that be? Right? So anyway, it's one of those good things, important things to be aware of. Okay. So let's break this down. Let's understand a little bit of what's going on here. Now, one of the things though that we do get a little overly excited about, I think sometimes, is we do try and argue the December date. Now, what I'd like to suggest to you is we actually really don't know. So that's my big thesis. We have no idea when Christ was born. However, you may hear some people try and argue about it based on the fact that there were shepherds out there and you wouldn't have shepherds out at the time of December. Now, there are sources that you can find that say that, right? So here is Newsweek, a very credible source, saying that you would not have shepherds out in December. Okay, so interesting. This is William Hendrickson, who has gone out in 1953, and he decided to check for himself as to whether or not you would have shepherds. And here's what he says. He says, right near us, a few flocks of sheep were nestled. Even the lambs were not lacking. It was a moving sight. It is, now don't get tripped up by the double negatives, right? It is therefore definitely not impossible that the Lord Jesus was born in December because he saw shepherds there. Now, you know, we can go over the whole thing about like these were not Jewish shepherds. These were Bedouins. Like there's a whole thing to discuss about this. And it's 1950. So, you know, it's kind of a few years later, but this is what you're going to see when you go through the sources. You can look at these, and if you look at the slides, this is a book called In the Fullness of Time. Again, it argues for the other side. Once again, here's another one, Then and Now Bible Map Atlas. It argues for the other side. So what you're going to see is when you start going through sources, basically nobody knows. You may find shepherds who are out there today, but none of us can go back 2,000 years and figure out if they actually were there then. So I think it's important in trying to be honest and have integrity when we're talking to people about this, that really I think we should say, well, we don't actually know. Like the shepherds are sort of inconclusive as far as whether or not they were going to be out there. So we don't really have a whole lot of evidence as to exactly when he would have been born. Now, does anybody know when we get the first celebration of Christ's birth in December? So what was that? Yeah. So it goes back into the time of the 300s, and we actually have a Roman calendar that has December 25th marked on it as the birth of Christ. That's the first written record we have of it. And it is over 300 years after Jesus's birth, right? So let's just note that historically. And in fact, if you read, remember those guys I was quoting last night, some of those early church writers? If you read them, what's funny about it, specifically Origen, that we looked at, they will say, we don't know when Christ was born and we don't care. So that's sort of an interesting piece. Now, the reason that they say that is you may have actually heard Jehovah's Witnesses argue this before. They say, because birthdays are bad. And they argue that because there's two birthdays in the Bible and people die on both of them. So they say, we don't celebrate birthdays, right? So we're not going to, I mean, people are also born on them. Just in case you didn't figure that one out. But like there's, you know, there's other issues going on at that point in time. So the early Christians, doesn't mean it was right either, but the early Christians didn't know when Jesus was born and they did not care when he was born. So the shepherd story is relatively inconclusive. We don't know what time of the year it was, and that's okay. What we do know, though, is that there's a lot of things wrong with the way that people typically do remember this story. The first being the whole idea of the inn. Now, you've probably seen the scenes or watched the plays or heard about them or something like that, that has a frantic Joseph knocking on the doors of Bethlehem saying, "Let me in, let me have a place," right? All of this kind of thing. And everybody's like, "No, sorry, we're full," you know? So eventually, like, he tries to go to the hotel and the hotel's like, "No, no beds. You have to go to the stable," right? So Joseph ends up in the stable. Well, just to kind of put that idea to rest, I think it's important to notice we are suffering from a case of bad translation here, in which it says there was no place for them in the inn. Now, that word could be translated as inn. That is a possible translation for it, but it's not the one that makes sense here, because that's not the typical kind of thing that happens. Right? Remember, Joseph and Mary are going down to Bethlehem. Why? Yeah, it's a census. And because of the census, where do they have to be? In the town that their family is from. So what they're doing is they're actually going back to where their relatives are. Right? So traditionally, we would expect then that they would actually be staying with relatives. That would make the most sense. Now, a lot of people are coming there, so the house is probably packed, right? So that's what's going on here. This is the guest room in a relative's house. Now, I don't know what, you know, family relations are like, but there's probably not the kind of situation where somebody comes to your house and you tell them to go sleep in the stable, right? Like, that's not generally a thing. So I want us to just kind of recognize this. We're looking at, this is a guest room. Now, this word shows up a few other places, and you will notice it makes a lot more sense translated as guest room, right? So this is the Last Supper, when Jesus has sent his disciples to go find that guest room. And it would not make any sense if this were the inn, right? The teacher says, "Where is my inn, that I may eat the Passover with my disciples?" Right? Like, what? Where is my inn? Now, number one, Jesus would have known where the hotel was in Jerusalem. And in addition to that, he probably didn't own one. So that would be a little strange to say, "Where is my inn?" So where is my guest room? That makes more sense. Where is the guest room? In fact, when you go through the Gospel of Luke, you will notice that there actually is a more typical word for inn, and Luke uses it. So this is your normal word for inn. It's pandocheon, and that means hotel. So that's why it shows up in the parable of the Good Samaritan, that he brings him to an inn, not a guest room. He brings him to an inn. So that's your normal word, and we know that this is definitely the actual hotel, because look what it has. It has an innkeeper at it, right? So this is your normal word for hotel. That is not what Luke uses here. So instead, this is not like they go to the hotel says, "Sorry, no vacancy," and they end up in the stables. Instead, they probably ended up in something like this. Now, you might think that looks sort of like a jail, so let's break this down a little bit. This is a picture of the city of Chorazin. So this is Chorazin, which you may recognize as lumped together with Capernaum in the gospel records, right? So up near Galilee in the north. What you're looking at here is where the animals were kept. Now, again, this is a little bit different historically as well than what we normally think. See those holes there? So the animals would be kept on the other side of those holes, and the holes were there for the animals' heads. So what the animals would do when they got hungry is they would stick their head out, and all their food would be on the other side here. They would eat the food. So this is where the animals lived. Now, what's interesting about that is that's actually part of the house. So if you look at ancient homes in the first century, they all have this, where people would keep their animals. And that's because animals were a big deal. You didn't want to just leave your animal, like, far off, because that was your livelihood, right? That was what you had. So you actually kept your animals in your home because you cared about them. He wanted to make sure that they were taken care of. Now, by the way, I'd say that actually opens up this story a little more. If you've ever wondered about the whole Jephthah thing and you've thought, like, what kind of crazy dude would say, I'm going to offer one of my kids when they walk out the door, right? Well, that's not what he was expecting. He was expecting an animal that you would normally offer, right? That was typical because people kept their animals in the house. So when we see this whole picture of Joseph and Mary at the inn, this is actually Joseph and Mary at their relative's house, in the house, just being in the section that the animals lived in. Right? So it wasn't like they were, you know, being shoved off or whatever. It was kind of like, well, we don't have a whole lot of room, but yes, stay here. You can be here in the house, but because everybody's kind of descended on us, you know, make do here with what we got. So that's what we're looking at. So this is your typical first century house. You will notice, see the little cute goat up there, right? So they're very much in the house. This is where the animals lived. So there's your first century house. Here's another one for you. So it is well established archaeologically. It is understood universally by scholars that the animals lived in the house. Here's another one for you. You can even see the little stables on the top right. All right, so that's probably what we're looking at. Now, when it comes to the shepherds, there's another piece here of the story that we need to break down a little bit. First off, why shepherds? Well, it's interesting that when you look at the main prophecy that talks about it being Bethlehem, where Messiah would be born, it also discusses shepherds. You can see right after the ellipsis, it says, he shall stand and shepherd his flock in the strength of the Lord, in the majesty of the name of the Lord his God. And then it mentions shepherds down there again near the end of the paragraph. So the shepherds already biblically connected to the idea of Messiah being born at Bethlehem. In addition to that, you'll just notice that the narrative really links together with this Micah 5 passage, the shepherds being one of those pieces. So you have Bethlehem mentioned there in Micah 5. You have him being a ruler mentioned in Micah 5. The birth actually taking place there in Micah 5. Peace being offered to the people in Micah 5. And then shepherds as well. So that could be one reason specifically why shepherds are invited there, that you can see that there's this prophecy coming together. In addition to that, others have tried to speculate on this and tried to come up with ideas. And what I'd like to suggest to you is that their ideas are totally wrong. So, this is a guy named Randy Alcorn. You have probably never heard of him. Neither have I. But he is a well-known writer here. You'll notice he's published by Crossway. And he's written this book called Come Thou Long Expected Jesus. I took this as like a sample for you. This is what a lot of people say. Now, unfortunately, we're going to see that this is probably wrong. So here's what Randy Alcorn says. He says, in Christ's days, shepherds stood on the bottom rung of the Palestinian social ladder. They shared the same unenviable status as tax collectors and dung sweepers. Only Luke mentions them. Now, it is interesting that in that sense, Randy Alcorn is correct. That is true. Shepherds were on the bottom of the rung. The problem is that he's missed a little bit of nuance here. And this is why, you know, a lot of these like feel good Christian kind of books, they go in weird places, right? So this is why we want to be careful when we see stuff like this. But this is very much just thought of, I think, societally, that this is the way that people think of this story. As we gaze on nativity scenes and smile at those gunny sack shepherds, let's not lose sight of the striking irony. A handful of shepherds, marginalized by the social and religious elite, were chosen to break the silence of centuries, heralding Messiah's birth. Okay. So thank you, Randy Alcorn, but that's not true. Here's why. We're going to spend a little bit of time. We're going to go through some of the sources and let's actually put this together to understand what is taking place here. I would suggest to you, yes, shepherds were at the bottom of the social rung, but these ones weren't. And that's why we can't miss the nuance. So before we get into this, I gave you a very quick rundown of the Talmud before, but we need to have a little bit of a stronger foundation as we jump into the Mishnah and the Talmud in order to understand what these things are. So let's do that. We're going to go back up to the Babylonian captivity. Anybody know what year that is? What year is Jerusalem destroyed? 586. 586. By the way, I asked the teens that, and one of them knew. I was very impressed with that. Pretty cool. Anyway, so 586 BCE, Babylon is destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar, right? 586 BCE, Babylon destroyed. What ends up happening, and let's just place ourselves in the shoes of the Jewish captivity, let's think about what this would have been like. So you're taken away from Jerusalem, the temple is gone, you're in Babylon. Let's think about some of the problems that would exist as a result. So how about this? Three times a year, all the males are told to go to Jerusalem to celebrate the different Jewish holidays. Guess what you can't do anymore? You can't do that, right? So what do you do? Now, even more than that, you weren't just supposed to go to Jerusalem three times a year, but there was a daily offering that was supposed to be offered in the morning and in the evening at the temple. That can't happen. So if you're Jewish and you're in Babylon, you're reading the Torah, and you're reading three times a year, all your males will appear before the Lord, and you're reading every morning, every evening, you will offer an offering. What do you do? Right? You have commandments. These are the commands of God. And you're looking at them and you're like, wow, this is bad. Right? You know, what do I do about this? Now, I'd suggest to you, this is something like what we saw yesterday, where the priest would open up the curtain and see nothing, right? When the Day of Atonement was taking place, God purposefully built things into the law so that people would say, we can't do this, right? And so when the temple is destroyed, God is purposefully forcing it on the people to have to wrestle with, wait a minute, we can't possibly keep the commands. Now, what's fascinating about this is, on one hand, some of the exiles start to go in the right direction, and they start to say, hey, wait a minute, maybe it's not actually about the commands themselves. Maybe it's about the spirit behind them, the principles. So that's exciting. Now, here's what's really weird about that. Do you know what that group of people was called? They were called the Pharisees. So this is where the Pharisees come from. So the Pharisees begin, the seeds of the Pharisees develop in the Babylonian exile, and they then eventually come to power in that time period between the Testaments. So that's why the Pharisees suddenly exist in the New Testament and they didn't in the Old, right? So that's the Pharisees. Now, that might be a little bit surprising because we often talk about the Pharisees and the letter of the law. That's actually the Sadducees. The Sadducees were all about the letter. They said, look, the temple's destroyed. We can't keep the law. It's all about keeping the letter, but someday we'll be back and we'll be able to keep it again. All right, so that's what the Sadducees said. The Pharisees said, we need to know the spirit of it. Now, unfortunately, like that was a good start, but where they went astray was they said, so the solution is actually more laws. So they said, here's the plan, right? We're not going to have these specific commands. We can't keep them anymore. So we need to know the spirit of the law, and then we'll just make more laws so that we can keep the spirit of the law. That is what's known as the Mishnah. So let's talk about the development of that Mishnah. The Pharisees conveniently said, right, this is why Christ gets so angry with them. They conveniently said, well, you know how the Torah is written down? They say, actually, God gave another Torah called the Oral Torah, which you can figure out from its name. That would be the one that's not written down. Again, very convenient. So they said God actually gave another Torah to Moses called the Oral Torah. Now, because the Oral Torah wasn't written down, none of you guys have seen it before, but Moses got it from God because God knew he would need it at some point. So he passed it on to Joshua, who then passed it on to the elders, and surprise, it was passed on to our ancestors, said the Pharisees, right? And the Pharisees say, so here's what it is. This is the Oral Torah, the words of God, they say. These are the words of God for a time like this, and it's different laws on how to continue to keep the spirit of the law, when we're in places like exile and things like that. So the Oral Torah was new laws that they claimed came from God. Eventually, those laws got written down in about 200 CE because they didn't want to lose them. And that's what became the Mishnah. So the Mishnah is what was orally passed down from generation to generation. We see it first starting around the time of the Babylonian exile. And then it just continues to develop until you get it written down in the Mishnah. So the reason that the Mishnah is helpful is because it shows us these are actually the things that the Pharisees were teaching. Right? So these are the teachings of the Pharisees that were around in the first century. The Talmud is then a commentary on that. Now, we're going to go through both, and I hope that you can see why Christ gets so frustrated with it. Right? This is what he refers to as the traditions of the elders. Okay, ready? That was all so that this makes sense. So, shepherds, right? That's what we're talking about. We're looking at shepherds and how first century Jews understood shepherds. So take a look at the Mishnah here. So this is the tradition of the elders. Here's what it says about shepherds. One may not raise small domesticated animals, i.e. sheep and goats, in settled areas of Eretz Yisrael. That's Hebrew. That means the land of Israel. As they graze on people's crops. So in other words, you can't be a shepherd, they said. That's illegal, bad. And so remember, these are like the new laws that they created. So that's one of the laws. One of the commands of God is don't be a shepherd. Okay. Now the Talmud decides to comment on this. And as I said, it's commentary, right? And this is one of the interesting things about, remember in Matthew 7, where people are listening to Christ and they say he spoke as one who had authority. And not as the scribes. You'll just notice, listen to how the scribes talk, right? His students asked Rabban Gamliel, that, by the way, Rabban Gamliel is Gamaliel. What is the halakha? Halakha means the way that you walk. In other words, the idea is like, how do you actually fulfill the law, is what they're asking. What is the halakha with regard to raising small domesticated animals in Eretz Yisrael? Rabban Gamliel said to them, it is permitted.
Oh, do you notice that? Rabban Gamliel just contradicted the Mishnah. Uh-oh.
The Gemara, that's the commentary, the Gemara interrupts its citation of the Baraita is the story, to pose a question. How could Rabban Gamliel say this? Didn't we learn in the Mishnah one may not raise small domesticated animals in Eretz Yisrael? Rather, the text of the Baraita must be amended, and they actually raised this dilemma before him. So they're saying, how could Rabban Gamliel contradict the Mishnah? He couldn't have, right? Because that's the oral law, like, given by God. So that must be a mistake. So instead, here's what was really meant, says the Talmud. What is the halakha with regard to keeping them for a while? Right? So they weren't asking, can you have animals or not? They were asking, can you babysit animals, right? So that's the big question. Are you allowed to babysit a sheep? Okay. Now, by the way, if you're thinking like, are you for real? Like, how do they actually have like texts on can you babysit sheep? And I am totally for real, right? Like this is a thing, right? It's called Daf Yomi. So Jews will read through the Talmud one page every day, right? It takes them 7 years to get through the whole thing. I do Daf Yomi, right? So I do this just to read through the Talmud so I know when I'm talking to Jews, like what I'm talking about, right? And this is the kind of stuff that gets argued about like every day, right? It's just these things like, can you babysit a sheep? So this is what we're looking at. The Gemara resumes the quotation of the Baraita. Rabban Gamliel said to them, it is permitted, so you can babysit sheep, provided that the animal does not go out and graze among the flock, right? So you can babysit a sheep as long as it stays in your house, and rather one should tie it to the legs of the bed in his house. So you are allowed to babysit a sheep as long as it's tied to your bed. But otherwise, no, you're breaking God's law. Okay, so you can digest that one for a little bit. Think about that. Okay, here's another one for you. Rabbi Yishmael said, the members of my father's family were among the wealthy property holders in the Upper Galilee. Okay, so now notice, we're not talking about Judea anymore. We're talking about Upper Galilee, right? So in the north. And look at where Rabbi Yishmael goes. This shows you, again, how people felt about breaking that Mishnah, right? For what reason were they destroyed? Oh, I'll tell you. It was due to the fact that they grazed flocks in the forest. So, what was the big issue? Well, they didn't babysit sheep. They actually had sheep. They were wiped out, he says. No sheeping. Okay. Here's another one. Rav Huna said to him, Hova, my wife, watches the animals to ensure that they do not graze on land belonging to others. Rav Ada Barahava cursed Rav Huna and said to him, may Hova bury her son. In all the years of Rad Ava Barahava, no children of Rav Huna from Hova survived due to this curse. So this is saying, you know, this is another kind of crazy thing. It's because she had sheep, right? She would never have any children. Now, this is, again, the way that the Talmud works. The Talmud loves to curse people. So there's a lot of like cursing going on, a lot of calling other people Satan, things like this. It was the way of the day back then. So that's how that goes. Now, we're not going to look at them all. You can read them if you want. I put a bunch in for you just so that you can check them. What I'd like to bring out is you can see why Randy Alcorn and those who agree with him said the kind of stuff that they did, because it was seen as bad to have sheep, right? You weren't supposed to have any little sheep running around unless you were babysitting them and they were tied to your bed. However, there was an exception. And so this is the thing, right? Sometimes when people are researching this stuff, they don't go far enough. So let me actually show you what the exception was. This is now Mishnah Shekalim. Here's what it says. If an animal that is fit for the altar was found straying from Jerusalem and as far as Migdal Eder, and similarly, if it was found within that distance from Jerusalem in any other direction, it is presumed that the animal came from Jerusalem. Most of the animals in Jerusalem were designated for offerings, and presumably this one was as well. So you were bad if you had small animals around, right? Unless you lived near Jerusalem or Migdal Eder. Because if you had small animals and you lived near Jerusalem and Migdal Eder, what would your animals be used for? They were sacrifices, right? Now, that's interesting because that actually turns this whole thing around. So you could be the bad person who's not babysitting sheep, you're actually owning sheep, or you could be the good person who has sheep for sacrifices. Now, just to like bring out historically what a big deal this was in Judaism to have a sheep for offerings, let's just talk a little bit about Aristobulus and Antigonus. Okay, so these are two brothers. They were Maccabees. You've heard of the Maccabees before, perhaps? So the Maccabees were the Jewish rulers in the time between the two Testaments. These two brothers are fighting one another, and they're fighting over who's going to be king. Right? So they couldn't figure it out. They couldn't decide who was going to be king. So they're fighting each other, and what ends up happening is one of them besieges the other one in Jerusalem. Right, so he's trying to conquer Jerusalem, trying to kill his brother. And at one point, the guy in Jerusalem says, he sends a letter to his brother and he says, I have a problem. You're bringing about the siege, you know, and that's fine. Like, we're fighting, I understand. You're bringing about the siege, but we have a really big issue. And the issue is that because of your siege, guess what I didn't do today? I didn't offer the morning offering, and I'm not going to be able to offer the evening offering. Right, there's no sheep for me to offer. And what's crazy is the brother on the outside who's besieging his brother, trying to kill him, right? He says, whoa, thank you for telling me. Like, I can't believe that. And so in the middle of a war, you ready for what he does? He takes a sheep every morning and every evening. He hooks up a pulley system to the walls of Jerusalem. And he sends a sheep up the wall, right? So this is what a big deal having an offering was. So in other words, if you were a shepherd, you were way low on the social structure, unless you were a shepherd in Jerusalem, from Jerusalem to Migdal Eder. And the question is, what is Migdal Eder? Right? What is this thing? Well, good news for you. Migdal actually is just a Hebrew word meaning tower. So the Tower of Eder is what we're talking about. So from Jerusalem to the Tower of Eder. Now, that might not help very much. What is the Tower of Eder? Well, it shows up twice in the Bible. You'll notice this is Genesis 35. This is Rachel's death. Where does Rachel die? Be specific. Yes, on the way to Bethlehem, right? So she doesn't die at Bethlehem. She dies on the way to Bethlehem. And so what ends up happening is Jacob sets up a pillar over Rachel's tomb. It's the pillar of Rachel's tomb, which is there to this day. Israel journeyed on and pitched his tent beyond the Tower of Adar. In other words, the Tower of Adar is probably on the other side of Bethlehem. Does that make sense? Other side of Bethlehem, they're journeying towards Bethlehem. She's buried on the way to Bethlehem, and then he ends up camping out near the Tower of Adar. Now, Bethlehem's only about 4 miles from Jerusalem, so it's not very far. And so it makes sense, then, that those who lived in that general area would be those who raised the sheep. So in other words, these shepherds are not the people that would be cursed by the Pharisees. They would not be saying, you guys are so bad, why are these not tied to your bed? You know, that kind of thing. They'd be saying, thank you for raising the offerings, right? This was actually a position of status, because without these guys, the people would be in trouble. There wouldn't be a system of worship. This is the other place, by the way, Micah 4:8, and you'll notice it's connected. This tower of the flock, that's Migdal Adar. And that's connected to Jerusalem, Bethlehem area, once again. So when the angel goes to the shepherds, the angel is not actually going to the people that were considered the lowest class of society. He's actually going to somebody that were pretty important in society at that point in time. You'll see that in Philo, right? So Philo was a Hebrew Jewish philosopher at the time. He lived in Alexandria, and that's actually what he says about shepherds. I won't read it to you for time, but you can see it in the slides. He says, shepherds are kind of a big deal. Right? This is a good occupation. Now, I think then we can actually see that that's why, like, have you ever noticed this? That's why the shepherds knew that Messiah would be born in Bethlehem. Do you ever notice that the angel doesn't tell them where to go? Isn't that funny? The angel said to them, fear not, for behold, I bring you good news of great joy that will be for all people. For unto you is born this day in the city of David a Savior. Now you might be thinking, what are you talking about? He says the city of David. Bethlehem is the city of David, that's true. The city of David's also somewhere else. It's also Jerusalem, right? That becomes the city of David and is often referred to as the city of David. And yet these shepherds didn't accidentally go to Jerusalem and be like, hey, everybody, we're here looking for, you know, the Savior. That's not what happened. They went straight to Bethlehem. Why? Because these are people who actually knew stuff, right? They knew, oh, that means Bethlehem. That's also then why when the shepherds go and talk to everybody about what they've seen, it's not this picture of, hey, did you hear that crazy dude? Right? Why people actually listen, right? People hear the shepherds and they're like, whoa, that's amazing. Our word there, they wondered, doesn't mean they wrote them off. It actually means they marveled and they thought, wow, that's astonishing. You know, they thought about these things. But didn't Christ come for the poor, for the outcasts? Yeah, he did. And I think that's what's so powerful about Luke 1 and 2. What we see here is that, in fact, we get everybody from every social class all brought together. Right? Jesus came for the priests, that's Zechariah. He came for the blameless, that's Elizabeth. He came for the engaged pregnant woman, right? That's Mary. He came for those who supported the temple, that would be the shepherds. He came for the prophets, Simeon and Anna. He came for the teachers, that's the teachers in the temple at the end of Luke 2, right? And that is why the angel, when the angel talks to the shepherd, he says, fear not, for behold, I bring you good news of great joy that will be for all the people. Not just the poor, not just the rich, not those who are in whatever social standing. It's specifically for everyone, wherever they're at, whatever's happening.
And so the you there is plural. For unto you all is born this day in the city of David a Savior. That's us too. So there's a proclamation given. We have 5 minutes. I'm going to jump to this one part. I'd like to just match this all up for you. Oh man.
Oh, that's rough. Okay. So I want to just wrap it up by talking about this. There's the manger. Sorry. We'll have to talk about that later. Okay. One of the most interesting things I think about the announcement that's given here is that when the angel announces the birth of Christ, he says, unto you is born this day, city of David, a Savior who is Christ the Lord. One of the things that's fascinating about that proclamation is that it is in your face completely against Caesar. And I think that that's a historical piece that we don't often pick up, but I want to just show you some of these coins. This is Julius Caesar. If you look at the one on the right, at the left-hand side, it says DVF. I don't know if you can see that. DVF. That stands for Divi Filius, which in Latin is Son of God. So I don't know if you are aware, but this was a title that the emperors took, Son of God, right? So here's Octavian, and it says Divius Iuliu, which again, same kind of idea, divine, right? And you'll notice, to show his divinity, he claims that his birth is connected to a star. Crazy, right? Now, another one for you, you can actually see the star on his palace, right? On his temple. See that at the top? And right above his head there on the left, you'll see it again. It says Divi Filius. So Son of God. Son of God associated with a star. This is the Provincial Assembly of Asia Minor. So this is an original Roman document, right? Listen to this. This is pretty crazy. So this is the kind of stuff that was said about Caesar in that period of time. Caesar has fulfilled the hopes of all earlier times, not only in surpassing all the benefactors who preceded him, but also in leaving to his successors no hope of surpassing him. And whereas, finally, that the birthday of the God has been for the whole world, the beginning of the gospel concerning him. Therefore, let all reckon a new era beginning from the date of his birth, and let his birthday mark the beginning of the new year. So you see what this is saying? They use the term gospel there. Now it's euangelion, which is really the good news, right? It's talking about the good news that he has brought. Now, that's not an accident, by the way, that Christianity refers to the message of Christ as the gospel. Right? All of this, again, historically, is something that is put together specifically to say, here is Caesar. Caesar promises that he's the Son of God. He's the one who has good news for the world. And what does Caesar have for you? Well, 10% of you get to be citizens. Wow. The rest of you get to be slaves. Sounds great. For all people. That's Christ. He's there for the rich. He's there for the poor. And so when the angels come and you have the multitude of the heavenly hosts, you're hit with the fact that God is grace. And because God is grace, that means that this is good news, not just for those in high standing, not just for those who are poor and who are suffering, but this is good news for everyone. It's good news for us where we are today, because the message of Christ is the message for everyone that's extended out to give that grace to all those who recognize their need for it.